Was James Conley coached? Quote, "It is hard to conceive that any man's power of fabrication of minute details could reach that which Conley showed, unless it be the truth." End quote. Governor John Slayton. Quote, "The best nigger I have ever seen." End quote. Leo Frank. For 100 years, believers in the innocence of Leo Frank have grappled with his resounding judicial defeat by claiming that the trial testimony of James Conley was a story entirely fabricated and fed to him by police and prosecutors. In this configuration, Conley is the puppet with an incredible knack for delivering a prepackaged storyline. The alternative charge is that Conley himself made up the entire tale and masterfully deceived the entire American justice system right on up to the United States Supreme Court. Steve Oney fluctuates between the two. Quote, "Conley was either the most infamous and creative liar who has ever walked the face of this city, or he was set up. It's one or the other. And I choose to believe that he was a great, great liar." End quote. Thus, Oney appears to be making two competing claims: that the white men who prosecuted Frank were engaged in an anti-Semitic persecution, but that, contrarily, they were all innocent victims of a Negro Svengali. He does not feel obligated to prove either or to reconcile the conflicting claims. The traveling stage play about the case, Parade by Alfred Urey, chooses the former, making Conley a co-conspirator with the politically ambitious prosecutor Hugh Dorsey. Luther Z. Rosser, frustrated in court by Conley's impenetrable testimony, introduced the coaching charge. Question: How many times did Mr. Dorsey see you in jail? Answer: About 3 times. Question: How many times did he see you at the police station? Answer: About 4 times. Question: Then it took Mr. Dorsey 7 visits to get your story straight? Why didn't you tell it all before he had been to see you 7 times? Answer: I didn't want to tell it all at first. Rosser did not try to prove the point, nor did the Frank defense team press the issue in any of their trial appeals. Only in rhetorical outbursts did this charge get an airing. And it is more likely that Rosser's claim was the result of his having been professionally bested in open court by 2, quote, niggers, end quote, and thus needing a worthy white adversary to take the blame for his own defeat. After the trial, Reuben Arnold added to the alleged plot the female witnesses who exposed Frank's, quote, lascivious, end quote, character, but in a newspaper interview, not in any official proceeding. Quote, "These witnesses were all hostile to Frank. They were coached, rehearsed, prepared to tell their little tales, and had we cross-examined them, there is no telling on God's earth what they would have been ready to tell. The Lord only knows what fabrications they would have put before the court. The prosecution had a regular school for training and rehearsing its witnesses, and whoever was the most perfect remembered his or her story the best, was put at the head of the class. Therefore, we would have made a very, very disastrous mistake in cross-examining any of them. The state, in obtaining its witnesses, gave a bid to the discharged employee, the men or women who hated wealth, and was willing to defeat it in the spirit of the anarchist, and the basely ignorant persons who were prejudiced against the Jew. We were trapped. We were between a conspiracy hatched up by Dorsey and his colleagues, the detectives, and a jury untrained in weighing the evidence, and too frightened to do so had they been properly trained." End quote. But the only evidence that has ever been offered to support the serious felony of coaching witnesses to perjure themselves is the fact that Dorsey several times interviewed Conley, a routine procedure in criminal cases. Frank himself attaches nefarious aims to those meetings. Quote, Conley was continuously under the tutelage of the detectives and the solicitor. End quote. Dorsey. Quote, having seen the latter 7 times. It is passing strange that, in the working up of a case, a witness upon whose testimony so much depended should be so tenderly nurtured and so often visited by the prosecuting attorney. End quote. Again, this all must be consigned to defense posturing, for no details were ever supplied and no complaint was ever filed, nor were charges ever levied. Arnold's alleged, quote, regular school for training and rehearsing its witnesses, end quote, was never mentioned again. Leo Frank, however, thought there was no inconsistency in the fact that several of his own attorneys and hired detectives visited him daily while he was incarcerated, in an area of the jail cordoned off just for that purpose. They planned out his defense strategy and carefully rehearsed with him his own unsworn trial statement. The alleged coaching to give perjured testimony, as opposed to coaching and presentation skills, i.e. diction, manner, control of emotions, etc., would have to have been quite an involved process, given that Conley's testimony was nearly 16 hours, the longest in the state's history. Yet, the alleged coaching scheme utterly collapses under the weight of its own absurdity. That white men of prominence and standing in Jim Crow, Georgia, would conspire to embrace and protect, quote, a low type of Negro, end quote, guilty of the rape and murder of a white child, in order to pin said crime on a prominent white man, is the scenario that Frank's supporters demand the public to believe. The co-claim that Conley could bamboozle the entire court system, the press, and the public, in the state with the highest lynching rate in the Union, is equally absurd and self-evidently preposterous. The observation by University of California historian Albert Lindemann is telling. Quote, even today, one must wonder how Dorsey himself could have embarked on such a risky enterprise as coaching Conley in a fabricated testimony, knowing him to be guilty and surely knowing what experts in cross-examination could do to a witness who had concocted an elaborate false testimony. It seems, moreover, unbelievable that Dorsey and the other lawyers for the prosecution, end quote, Frank, quote, Hooper, and, end quote, Edward A., quote, Stevens, could have been so reckless as to thus risk a humiliating collapse of their case against Frank, and what might have happened to their reputations and future careers if Conley, having broken down in full courtroom, had testified that Dorsey coached him in false testimony? End quote. Conley recounted instances and events that had no bearing on the case, all of which could be traced for verification. His recollection of walking Atlanta streets together with Frank, through an open market with many customers, for instance, placed Frank out in the public with a man Frank says he never saw on the day of the murder. No prosecutor concocting a tale for a witness would have allowed so many chances for refutation. In addition to that, some of the most damaging parts of Conley's testimony were about Frank's history of sexual activities at the factory, not about his actions on the day of the murder. His revelations helped build the prosecutor's charge that Frank had developed a system and pattern of sexual encounters with young girls in which he intended to entrap Mary Fagan. So the alleged coaching would have to have included a range of time and events spanning months, rather than just those activities occurring on the day of the murder. Further, it is clear both the prosecutor and the defense knew what Conley could say on the matter of Frank's sexual affairs, but there was but a minuscule chance that the subject would come up at trial. By Georgia trial rules, it would be entirely up to Frank's defense lawyers to raise the specter of their client's character, and Dorsey never would have expected that Frank's highly experienced attorneys would so easily subject their client to that swamp of unseemly evidence. In their pre-trial analysis, Even the amateur trial speculators at the Atlanta Constitution discussed the remoteness of that possibility, stating that there is not, quote, one chance in 100, end quote, that Frank's team would allow this line of attack. To everyone's astonishment, Frank's legal eagles flew right into that swamp. And when they did, Conley was just one of many who convincingly testified to the sleazy side of Frank's personality. None of the testimonies conflicting with the known facts or with each other. So the coaching of Conley to convincingly recite testimony that had the most improbable chance of being heard would have been an extraordinarily time-consuming and fruitless effort, and a professionally perilous gamble. The coaching of a witness to commit perjury in a trial setting presents its own set of difficulties, but the coaching of a witness to physically reenact a fabricated set of behaviors poses an altogether different set of challenges. On May 30th, James Conley was taken from jail to the scene of the crime, where he walked officials and reporters through the National Pencil Company, demonstrating his involvement in helping Frank conceal Mary's body. According to those reporters who witnessed the scene, Conley did not appear to be concocting anything. Quote, "The Negro's pantomime was thorough in detail. He overlooked no part depicted in his astounding confession of the night before. He often even lay down upon the floor so as to minutely picture the position of the victim's body at certain stages of its removal into the cellar. With wavering voice that frequently choked slightly as though from some tragic recollection of the grim occurrence, he verbally explained his actions on the murder day." End quote. Another consideration that factors against the coaching claim is that Conley is but one of many whose corroborating evidence had to synchronize with his storyline. Indeed, Hugh Dorsey would have had to stage manage an elaborate choreography of, quote, anti-Semitic lies, end quote, and evidentiary fabrications, starting with two of the most prominent and staunchly independent detective firms in America, the Pinkerton and the William J. Burns agencies. Neither was based in Georgia, and it is highly unlikely that either would risk its national reputation to join in with the, quote, anti-Semitic, end quote, scheming of some politically ambitious local prosecutor. Moreover, both these nationally known competitors, whilst they were both on Frank's payroll, independently concluded that Frank did indeed murder Mary Fagan. At least 14 white witnesses corroborated Conley's story. Someone would have had to coach them all and keep them quiet in this grand conspiracy. Those falsified, perjured testimonies would have had to be scripted and coordinated to be even remotely convincing to an all-white male jury, to a white judge who had exhibited a clear pro-Frank bias throughout the trial, and to a white press that was competing daily to bring out every nuance of the trial. And all those cooperating white witnesses, none of whom were under any legal burden, would have had to agree to be part of an illegal scheme to lie under oath, not only to protect a lower-class Negro murderer, but to knowingly place a noose around the neck of their innocent employer, a prominent white man. As we will see, Frank unleashed a veritable army of strong-arm agents and dumped piles of cash on the so-called factory girls, inducing some of them to recant their damaging testimony. But in their recantations, often temporary, none of them described a, quote, regular school, end quote, for coaching witnesses. Ultimately, despite the defense pressure, all of these witnesses recanted their recantations, some even adding more lurid details about their dealings with Leo Frank. A measured assessment of the coaching charge inevitably finds the very idea collapsing of its own absurdity. Detective William J. Burns was rehired by Frank for his post-conviction extrajudicial operations, and he ultimately admitted that the talk about Dorsey being prejudiced, meaning anti-Semitic, was, quote, bosh, end quote. Quote, "The solicitor has done no more than to prosecute an important case in a very vigorous and capable manner," End quote. Coaching charges persist. The latest incarnation of this coaching claim appears in the 2009 PBS documentary series Frontline, which aired a 90-minute docudrama by writer, producer, and director Ben Loderman, titled The People vs. Leo Frank. With Steve Oney listed as chief consultant and the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith sponsoring many screenings of the film, the production must be taken as the, quote, official, end quote, account of the case by the believers in Frank's innocence. The film departs from many well-worn tropes, but it adds others. After nearly a century of recriminations, the production clears Dorsey entirely of the coaching charge. Instead, Loderman, following the thesis of Oney's book, advances the notion that Conley's attorney, William Smith, quote, coached, end quote, his client in his testimony at the trial. Smith entered the case at the end of May, once James Conley opened up to police about Leo Frank's role in Mary Fagan's murder. The Atlanta Georgian hired Smith to be the lawyer for the destitute and friendless factory sweeper as he sat in the Fulton County Jail. The Georgian's editors were not interested in Conley's civil rights. Instead, in the cutthroat competitive climate of Atlanta's three daily newspapers, they were angling for inside information about the case and the state's star witness. In his Frontline tale, Loderman conceals Smith's Georgian connection, but shows him tutoring Conley on how to tell a bulletproof tale in court. Loderman's is the first and strongest statement ever made on the alleged coaching process. But Smith also eludes condemnation by Frank partisans because after successfully, quote, coaching, end quote, the testimony of Conley, it is said that Smith went through a soul-searching process that resulted in his shifting his allegiance from his own client to Leo Frank. Loderman's tale nevertheless has fatal weaknesses that buckle under the most elementary analysis. It is true that after the trial and conviction of Frank, Smith turned against his black client and claimed to believe in his guilt. But in his highly publicized pirouette, he provided no proof of that claim, and there is evidence that suggests that Smith may have succumbed to defense pressure, not to a guilty conscience. And here is where Oney and Loderman's thesis loses its steam. If Smith were the primary, quote, coach, end quote, of James Conley, Smith could have detailed his role in preparing Conley for perjury. But in the 36 years he lived after the trial, he died in 1949, Smith never revealed or intimated any such nefarious consultations with Conley, sessions that Oney refers to as, quote, midnight seances, end quote. Smith did not reveal his interactions with Dorsey or the police or other witnesses, all of whom would be needed to properly coordinate any perjury. Nor did he charge that anti-Semitism played a part in his own or anyone else's actions. Had he done so, it would have provided enough evidence to free Leo Frank and hang James Conley. It would have broken the back of the prosecution's case and exposed the supporting witnesses as utter frauds. Smith's oddly worded statement to the press really didn't amount to much at all. Quote, I am sure that investigation by the proper authorities will prove conclusively that the black is the man who is the slayer. End quote. Steve Oney is the source for this threadbare coaching by Smith theory. But surprisingly, he devotes but a single paragraph of his 742-page book to this alleged coaching, in which he writes that, quote, over many long evenings, end quote, Smith trained Conley in the presentation arts. Quote, the lawyer edified his pupil on the rules of discourse, stressing the importance of enunciation, timing, and maintaining eye contact with an audience. Then Smith, a fair mimic, gave the Negro a taste of Luther Rosser's corrosive manner, preparing him for the inevitable courtroom encounter. End quote. Oney's description makes no mention of perjury and points only to that advice all trial lawyers offer their clients. He nonetheless provides but two sources for his, quote, coaching, end quote, claim. 1. His own 1986 interview with William Smith's youngest son, Walter, who was not yet born at the time of the Leo Frank affair, and thus has no first-hand knowledge of the alleged process. And 2. Leo Frank's own writings, though he was in jail at the time and thus could only offer self-interested speculation. None of Oney's, quote, account, end quote, is attested to by William Smith himself, nor by jail officials or newspaper reporters, nor by Frank's extensive staff of attorneys and private investigators. The Oney-Loderman theory leaves more questions than answers, thus compromising itself in the process. In the end, the charge of, quote, coached, end quote, testimony, subordination of perjury, or witness tampering, has no reliable foundation and leaves Leo Frank exactly as the jury sentenced him, duly convicted of the murder of Mary Fagan. I disremember. The Jewish mockery of a black man. Luther Z. Rosser's disastrous cross-examination of James Conley only gave prosecutor Hugh Dorsey more rope to hang Leo Frank. One part of that confrontation requires a closer look. As Rosser's game plan collapsed in open court, he resorted to an interrogation tactic that was designed to elicit from Conley the repeated response, quote, I don't know, end quote. In the abstract, the repetitive answer, quote, I don't know, end quote, makes Conley appear to be evasive, or to have a selective memory, or even to be coached. Frank's supporters argue that it is suspicious that Conley's mind seems so clear in testimony against Frank, but murky and even vacant when Rosser posed questions to him in Frank's defense. Harry Golden spoke for them. Quote, that Conley had a poor memory was patent. It seemed he could only remember the crime and Frank's perversion. As he continued, Rosser made Conley admit he was a liar. End quote. The key to understanding this testimony, however, is not in the memory of James Conley, but in the substance of Rosser's questions. His questions were designed to demand such detail that few could reasonably be expected to answer them with any accuracy. To wit, Rosser asked for details about the several times Conley acted as lookout while Frank had sexual trysts at the factory. Quote, how was she, end quote, one of the women, quote, dressed that night, end quote. Conley's answer, quote, I disremember, end quote. Referring to another time, Rosser demanded, quote, give me a description of those young ladies, end quote. Quote, I disremember what the ladies did have on, end quote. Quote, what did you do the Saturday before you watched for him the first time, end quote. Quote, I disremember, end quote. What did you do, quote, the Saturday after you watched for him the first time, end quote. Quote, I disremember, end quote. Rosser asked Conley for exact days when he was paid on the weeks that he watched for Frank. He asked Conley whether he had seen another factory employee on a specific day of the 5 days he had watched for Frank. And he asked who worked at the factory on Conley's days off. He asked Conley for the color of a man's eyelashes. He asked Conley what the wages were of other employees and what, quote, habits, end quote, and schedule they had in getting paid. He asked Conley to describe a man's clothes the second time he saw him. To all these types of questions, Conley answered, quote, I disremember, end quote, or, quote, I don't know, end quote, or, quote, I don't remember, end quote. What's more, Rosser was interrogating Conley about incidences that had occurred over a period of a year ending in 1912. But on the crucial and relevant details of the April 26, 1913 murder, which had occurred just 3 months before the trial, Conley was clear and lucid, his testimony incontrovertible. So, Conley's alleged selective memory must be viewed in the context of the leading questions he was being asked. Leo Frank's performance as a witness, however, has never been considered for its veracity and degree of forgetfulness. Conley's testimony was given about 100 days from the April 26th murder. Frank's only actual sworn testimony in an official hearing came just 10 days after the murder, during the coroner's inquest, on May 5th, 1913. There, Frank underwent approximately 4 hours of questioning about his activities on the day of the murder. The Atlanta Constitution's account of Frank's absent-mindedness covers only a small portion of his 4 hours on the stand, wherein he evasively answered, quote, "I don't know," end quote, to many easy questions. Quote, "Can you name the guests at the party at your house April 26th? End quote. Frank's answer, quote, "I don't remember them all," end quote. There were 7, and his own mother-in-law said that Frank spoke with them for 20 minutes. Quote, "What topic was discussed at home?" End quote. Frank's reply, quote, "I don't remember," end quote. Indeed, all of the family claimed to, quote, "disremember," end quote, any topic of conversation at that dinner party. More of Leo Frank's responses, taken from the Constitution articles, are counted and cataloged verbatim. "I don't remember," 10 times. "I don't recollect," 2 times. "I did not notice," 2 times. "I don't know," 2 times. "Not that I remember," 1 time. "I don't recollect that I did," 1 time. "I can't recollect," 1 time. "No, I forgot," 1 time. "No, I don't," 11 times. "I don't remember precisely," 1 time. The Atlanta Journal recorded similarly Frank's answers to the coroner's questions about his movements on the day of the murder. "I didn't notice," 3 times. "I don't remember," 3 times. "I don't recollect," 1 time. "I don't know," 1 time. "I wasn't asked," 1 time. At the same hearing, Leo Frank's father-in-law, Emil Selig, was asked about Frank's reaction on Sunday to the homicide at his factory the day before. Quote, "He seemed unconcerned," end quote. And, quote, "I didn't remember," end quote, Frank mentioning the murder the rest of the day. His mother-in-law, Mrs. Selig, coldly testified that Frank, quote, "mentioned it casually," end quote, and that she, quote, "didn't attach much importance to it," end quote. The Atlanta Georgian reporter heard Frank answer, quote, "I don't remember," end quote, so often that a section heading of the article was titled, quote, "Often does not remember," end quote. "I don't remember," 8 times. "I did not notice," 1 time. "I don't remember them all," 1 time. "I don't remember saying anything to her," 1 time. "I don't recollect," 1 time. "I don't recollect that I did," 1 time. It should not escape the notice of students of the case that this "I don't know" refrain of a seemingly forgetful and unobservant engineer is exactly what landed the factory superintendent on trial for murder. To Mary Fagan's last known question, quote, "Has the metal arrived yet?" end quote, Leo Frank gave the fateful response, quote, "I don't know," end quote, before leading her, the prosecution successfully argued, to her doom. Leo Frank's fight for redemption. Quote, "In all the annals of jurisprudence in the South, there never was the word of such an," end quote, "unaccountable," quote, "roustabout, and criminal," as, end quote, Conley, quote, "taken in preference to that of a clean and honorable white man," as in our case. "It seems too ridiculous to consider even for a moment," end quote. Rudolf Frank, father of Leo Frank. Judge Leonard S. Roan scheduled Leo Frank's public hanging for October 10, 1913. But no one who understood Frank's position at the top of Atlanta's Caucasian Jewish hierarchy believed that he would actually swing on the day prescribed. There was yet a long legal road to come of appeals, motions, and filings that would push the execution further and further into the future. The condemned man and his advocates saw that the potential for a reversal of his conviction within Georgia's legal system was unlikely, but that would not stop them from pursuing every possible angle. And though Frank received the longest and most expensive trial in the history of Georgia, was represented by the cream of the Southern establishment's law firms, and had the services of two of the best and priciest private detective agencies at his command, the Frank team understood that to save their man from the gallows, they would have to adopt a new, more dynamic strategy that took his fate out of the hands of the judiciary and put it into the much more manipulable court of public relations. The Frank team's post-trial plan recognized the need to broaden Frank's support base to include a national and international audience. For Georgians had, by and large, accepted that Hugh M. Dorsey had proved his case in a fair trial. Atlanta Jews were among those who accepted the verdict as regrettable but fair. According to two pro-Frank advocates, the city's Jews, quote, did not, in fact, assume an active role on Frank's behalf, end quote. And further, wrote Harry Golden, they really, quote, felt no sympathy for, end quote, him. He reiterates that, quote, five prominent members of the Jewish community were on the grand jury, and all voted with the majority to indict him, end quote. DeWitt Roberts, writing about the case for the Anti-Defamation League, observed, quote, apparently, except for close personal associates, his family and in-laws, Herbert Haas, some members of the, end quote, Atlanta, quote, journal staff, and Rabbi Marks, no one believed Frank innocent until after his conviction, end quote. Remarkable for its absence is a record of activities by the Jewish organization that Frank himself led, the Atlanta chapter of the Fraternal Order of the B'nai B'rith. The official history of the organization does not even mention the case that is credited with birthing the group's own Anti-Defamation League. Its first action was recorded a month after the trial, when the Atlanta Lodge symbolically re-elected Frank in an apparent statement of protest and support. It is ironic, though, that in that same election, Arthur Heyman, Hugh Dorsey's law partner, was elected as Frank's vice president. So, with a troubling dearth of local support from his own people, Frank's forces looked out of state to the broader world to bring pressure to bear on Georgia, its press, its people, and its judicial and economic systems. But to persuade outsiders to become actual crusaders for Frank's cause would require that they become acquainted with the case entirely from the convict's point of view. Georgians closely followed the trial through the extensive coverage by the three Atlanta dailies, but nationally, the case was almost entirely unknown. To Frank's savvy team of operatives, this universal ignorance constituted a vast audience of potential supporters, who could become activists if fed only the uncritical narrative of Leo Frank's victimhood and innocence. And so the need to generate a global outcry in Frank's favor is what motivated one of the most massive and well-oiled public relations campaigns in American history. So extraordinary in its scope and influence was the Leo Frank Crusade that it would ultimately dictate the world's view of the Mary Fagan murder case for a century. It was a campaign that cleverly and pointedly portrayed the convicted murderer as an innocent victim of a violent, state-sponsored religious bigotry. And through that distorted prism, a growing number of influential Jews from outside Georgia came to believe that Leo Frank's murder conviction was an egregious anti-Semitic injustice, which, if allowed to stand, would put all American Jews in mortal danger. The Jewish elite reacted to this manufactured threat by applying all their collective money, muscle, and guile to exonerate and free their imperiled fellow Jew. The layers of evidence that convinced a jury of white men of Frank's guilt in the murder of Mary Fagan, overwhelming as they were, simply never made it out of Georgia. The vast majority of Americans would never hear of the blood, the hair, the drag marks, the suspicious behavior of the convict, or his sexual transgressions. They would learn of Leo Frank for the first time as a sympathetic figure, a victim of organized, quote, anti-Semitism, end quote, on a par with that of other international cases where religious persecution was charged, as with Russian Mendel Bilis or Frenchman Alfred Dreyfus. Nor would the public learn of the ugly racist rhetoric on which Frank himself based his own ill-fated defense. With the case now deemed an, quote, international incident, end quote, Frank's unprecedented assemblage of the nation's powerful Jewish elites brought with it sizable reputations and just as sizable war chests. What followed was an all-out Jewish war against the guilty verdict. Of course, Georgia's Jim Crow justice system had always been grossly unjust toward its black victims, but this northern-based Jewish offensive to free Leo Frank was not intended to destroy Jim Crow discrimination or punish the whites who maintained it. Incredibly, Leo Frank's new focus would actually target the many blacks whose testimony was entered into the record of the case. What seemed to offend the Leo Frank team was not Georgia's racism per se. America's Jews were fine with that. It was the state's acceptance of testimony from its black citizens that was the egregious anti-Jewish wrong. Frank's aim, therefore, was to affirm and reinforce the hard and fast Jim Crow guarantee that the testimony of the black man was invalid and that the word of a white man always held sway. Leo Frank's racist trial strategy, which first attempted to implicate night watchman Newt Lee and then shifted to targeting factory sweeper James Conley, proved to be a spectacular failure. But the adverse outcome was obviously not enough of a disaster to make the Frank team abandon that approach. Frank's refashioned post-conviction team of advocates simply refined and amplified the racist tactic for a national and international audience. After all, in the court of public opinion outside Georgia, there would be no Hugh Dorseys to cross-examine or impeach the defense witnesses. The state of Georgia had neither the reach nor the inclination to fight the massive effort on such a broad scale, and Frank's people took great tactical advantage of those obvious limitations. Losing attorneys Luther Rosser and Reuben Arnold were kept on board but demoted to spokesperson roles, and Frank entrusted his legal and public appeals to a more cosmopolitan and urbane, non-Southern Jewish elite. Their focus was to surgically save a single Jew, while leaving the Jim Crow system intact. Southern and Georgian racial, quote, sensitivities, end quote, would be spared and accommodated. The direct target of Frank's new campaign would be the black man in the person of James Jim Conley. The money man behind Leo Frank, Albert Lasker. Frank's ever-growing legal team worked mightily and successfully to delay the execution of Leo Frank, going from courtroom to courtroom arguing technicalities, and each time eking out a few more weeks of existence for their client. In the meantime, other sectors of the Jewish community geared up to play a crucial role. With the help of such Jewish luminaries as Sears magnate Julius Rosenwald and Wall Street financier Jacob Schiff, many prominent Jews signed on to the Leo Frank movement. They were motivated and supervised by Frank's new patron saint, the Chicago-based, quote, founder of modern advertising, end quote, Albert D. Lasker. He was the head of Lord & Thomas, the largest and most profitable advertising agency in the world, but he would carefully avoid advertising his central role in the growing campaign. The effort to repackage the Leo Frank story, from that of convicted child rapist and murderer to that of innocent Jewish sufferer of anti-Semitic mob hysteria would take Lasker's particular promotional genius. It was he, after all, who made household names of products like Lucky Strike cigarettes, Chanel perfume, Pepsodent toothpaste, Kotex sanitary napkins, Quaker oats, Kleenex tissue, Palm Olive soap, Sunkissed oranges, Goodyear tires, and Budweiser beer. Lasker came from a prominent Texas family of Jewish slaveholders. His father, Morris, a retired real estate mogul and millionaire owner of two banks, was a Confederate veteran who styled himself as an, quote, Indian fighter, end quote, who, quote, engaged in many expeditions against the Indians, end quote. The elder Lasker was one of the first Jews outside Georgia to take an interest in the case. He viewed Leo Frank as the victim of an anti-Semitic judicial outrage and appealed to his powerful son to enter the case on behalf of Jewish justice. Albert Lasker dutifully complied, contacted his friend Arthur Brisbane, the editor of the popular New York Evening Journal, and they both traveled to Atlanta and met with the prosecutors, the defense counsel, and Leo Frank himself. Though Lasker became Frank's greatest financial backer and advocate, his recollection of their first meeting is disturbing. Quote, "Neither Brisbane nor I liked Frank. From our interviews, we found him a supercilious egotist who was enjoying this notoriety. We took a great prejudice against him, and we could see how it would add to the psychology of those against him who didn't have an open mind." Both, end quote, Brisbane, quote, and I took a tremendous prejudice against the prisoner, end quote, Leo Frank. Quote, "Like so many, all this publicity had gone to his head. He became a megalomaniac. So we disliked our principal very much, but we determined in our minds that he was innocent, and that this was a big frame-up," end quote. Lasker also used a strange configuration of words to describe the predicament Frank was in. He said that Frank was, quote, "legally not guilty," end quote, or, quote, "isn't legally guilty," end quote. Such phrasing is a strenuous distance from the straightforward declaration, quote, "he is innocent," end quote. Lasker's negative initial impression of Frank persisted, but his philosophical outlook on the meaning of the case for the Jewish people superseded his concerns. No doubt that Lasker believed he could conceal those highly negative personal traits in his repackaging of the convict. And certainly, he saw this monumental responsibility as a professional challenge. Lasker also had the skills to exploit the racial thrust of his Leo Frank sales campaign. He believed fully in white Jewish supremacy and seemed to harbor a belief that Gentiles were not worthy to judge Jews for any crime. Quote, "The Jews are a superior people. I have a hard time hiding that. I feel we should be patient with non-Jews. I deeply believe that no Christian civilization can last that removed from it the Jews, that it is the Jew that brings them the pollen." End quote. In fact, Lasker was a eugenicist, a believer in the need to genetically engineer human beings to form a superior society. And he was a believer long before Adolf Hitler purportedly turned the concept against the Jews. He and his third wife, Mary, ultimately became one of the eugenics movement's greatest supporters. So racism, an important element in Frank's new crusade, was indeed Albert Lasker's bailiwick and comfort zone. He emerged from a Southern elitist background very much like that of Frank himself. One of his biographers claims he, quote, "was very fond of Negroes," end quote, but betrays his and Lasker's shared racial delusions. Quote, "The Laskers had four servants, all of whom were Negroes except," end quote, "his mother's," quote, "maid." Albert got along with Negroes on the basis of trust and understanding. He never had the slightest taint of racial prejudice, which was unusual in somebody Texas-bred. End quote. Lasker dove headlong into the case, spending upwards of $120,000 of his own money, $2.9 million in 2016 dollars, to rebrand Leo Frank and to finance his legal defense, and he dedicated 9 months away from his ad agency to organize the massive effort. He created a sustained public relations bombardment on behalf of his fellow Jew that remains unrivaled in the annals of American criminal history. Lasker called it the, quote, "Truth on the March," end quote, campaign, and dictated that all media interviews, articles, and statements emanating from the Frank camp should carry that phrase. And skillfully evoking the final ordeal of the Christian Savior, Frank's sloganeers would claim that he was the innocent victim of, quote, "passion and prejudice," end quote. And in their written press releases, they would consciously place those words in the mouth of the convict. Lasker worked tirelessly, marshaling resources in the effort to build outside pressure on the state of Georgia to grant Leo Frank a new trial. Soon, an impressive group of leading Jews joined the growing coalition to free the convicted murderer now sitting on Georgia's death row. Louis Marshall, the legal power behind Leo Frank. The American Jewish Committee, AJC, formed as an organization in 1906 to represent the interests of the wealthy assimilated class of German-American Jews. And though Leo Frank shared their status and heritage, the group at first shied away from him, not wanting, quote, "to be perceived as championing the cause of a Jew convicted of a crime," end quote. But upon reflection, and much lobbying, the AJC board members overcame their apprehensions and donated money, time, and talent to Frank's cause and its growing symbolic significance to American Jews. The AJC was founded and led by attorney Louis Marshall, of the Wall Street firm Guggenheimer, Untermeyer, and Marshall, who was considered by many, including himself, to be the most prominent Jew in America. A so-called court Jew, privileged and well-regarded, Marshall earned back-stairway access to the inner sanctums of the powerful, including President Woodrow Wilson and the justices of the Supreme Court. And he considered himself on the national level to be, quote, "the spokesman for our citizens of the Jewish faith," end quote. Incentivized by the prodding and deep pockets of Albert Lasker, Marshall, as lead attorney, organized and engineered the legal strategy of the Frank case as it worked its way through the appeals process and up to the United States Supreme Court. Marshall's involvement was particularly noteworthy because he would later join the NAACP's Board of Directors, where he would have a hand in designing the legal strategy of the budding civil rights movement. Despite this lofty vita, Marshall was no racial liberal. When, in 1922, a Jewish group publicly stated their intention to organize to fight against the racial terrorist Ku Klux Klan, Marshall immediately tried to stop them. He sent a letter to the group's leader. Quote, "I think that you are making a grave mistake," end quote. Marshall's biographer, Morton Rosenstock, confirmed that Marshall and the American Jewish Committee, quote, "attempted to restrain their fellow Jews from taking precipitate anti-Klan action. Influential Jews, leaders of organizations, editors of newspapers and magazines, all were urged to refrain from making a Jewish issue out of the Klan. Marshall thought it unwise for Jewish fraternal groups, such as the B'nai B'rith, that were themselves secret orders, to condemn another secret order," end quote. Turns out, like Lasker, Marshall had a spiritual affinity for racist movements and doctrines. Marshall, the self-described leader of American Jews, was also a committed eugenicist. In 1912, 1 year before the murder of Mary Fagan, Marshall became the, quote, "main legal advisor," end quote, of the American Breeders Association in order to render a legal opinion on the, quote, "sterilization of criminals and degenerates," end quote. Marshall was not in the least bit horrified at the notion. Instead, he offered the breeders this sage advice and legal counsel. Quote, I understand that the operation of vasectomy is painless and has no effect upon the person upon whom it is imposed, other than to render it impossible for him to have progeny. If it could be said that such a punishment would only be inflicted in the case of confirmed criminals, there would be strong reasons, founded on considerations of the public welfare, which would justify its imposition. End quote. Like Adolf Hitler, Louis Marshall believed that compulsory sterilization should be public policy. In the same year that he took up the Frank case, 1914, Marshall was signatory to a frightening eugenics study that examined the, quote, best practical means of cutting off the defective germplasm in the American population, end quote. It was his legal determination that, quote, the movement is one which is based on sound considerations. The difficulty is, however, in adopting proper safeguards to adequately protect those who are not hopelessly confirmed criminals, degenerates, or defectives, end quote. He undertook to, quote, frame a model law permitting the sterilization of persons known to have defective germplasms, establishing criterion therefore, and providing for effective execution, end quote. It was this Louis Marshall who prepared the briefs to appeal Frank's guilty verdict. And from this point on, Frank's defense was a Northern Jewish operation. And with disconcerting ease, Lasker and Marshall adopted anew the virulent anti-black racism that Frank's Southern defense attorneys had injected into his Georgia trial. Marshall, calculatedly, spoke of James Conley not as a mere, quote, Negro sweeper, end quote, but as a, quote, degenerate Negro of criminal antecedents, end quote. Ignoring the horrific legacy of slavery, Jim Crow, and lynchings of blacks in America, Marshall proclaimed that, quote, never was there a greater crime against justice perpetrated, end quote, than that against Leo Frank. Eric Goldstein wrote of Marshall's approach, quote, while on the case, Marshall supported the policy crafted by Frank's Southern lawyers of trying to use the overwhelming power of the black-white divide in the South to Frank's advantage. The legal team took every opportunity to emphasize Frank's whiteness while trying to shift blame for the crime to Jim Conley, a black janitor, who had also been implicated in the murder. While the lawyers believed Conley to be the true assailant, they also felt that, as a black man, he would fit the jury's preconception of a rapist and murderer, thus helping to acquit Frank. End quote. No longer could, quote, Southern influence, end quote, be blamed for the bigotry emanating from the pro-Frank forces. Their obvious intent was to create, in the mind of white Americans, such a gulf between Leo Frank's refined white culture and heritage and the dark, primitive, simian roots of the crime for which he was convicted, that the white public would be duty-bound to conclude that only a black man could have murdered Mary Fagan. Jeffrey Melnick put it this way, quote, Frank's people tried to establish Frank's whiteness. And I mean that doubly here to signify his racial standing and his innocence. By demonstrating his distance from even the most trivial constituent of American culture that might be traceable to African Americans. End quote. Dr. Stuart Rockoff, director of the Goldring/Woldenberg Institute of Southern Jewish Life and the Museum of the Southern Jewish Experience, echoes that theme. Quote, for these assimilated German Jews, the denial of whiteness that was at the heart of the Frank case profoundly threatened them. They had largely accepted the ideology of white supremacy and conceived of themselves as white. All of a sudden, they realized that this status was insecure and contingent. Thus, their defense of Frank was largely an asserting of his and, by extension, their own whiteness. End quote. With white supremacy at the core of its appeal, the Frank campaign picked up unprecedented steam. Most significantly, Team Marshall and Lasker obtained the support of the owner of the largest and most widely read newspaper in the world, the New York Times. Adolf Ochs, the worldwide voice of Leo Frank. The Lasker Marshall Plan for Leo Frank's redemption called for the robust participation of the world's press. Louis Marshall contacted Adolf Ochs, the Jewish owner of the New York Times, who, after some initial squeamishness, agreed not simply to cover the case, but, as Leonard Dinnerstein put it, quote, to employ his newspaper as a weapon in the fight to exonerate Frank, end quote. Albert Lasker remembered it this way. Ochs, quote, said, so far as calling the nation's attention to it, you leave that to me. I am sending my best man down there today. And the New York Times ran the only murder crusade it ever ran on that. They ran as much as, beginning the week, as 5 pages a day, and page after page every day for months and months and months. End quote. One author characterizes Ochs's involvement not as coverage, but as an, quote, obsession, end quote. Lasker verified that, quote, Ochs went at it in the spirit of a crusader, and then the whole nation took it up, end quote. In December 1914 alone, Ochs printed 33 articles and 5 editorials about the case. From his Manhattan high-rise 800 miles from Georgia, Ochs carefully adhered to Marshall's program and focused his paper on the assassination of the character of, quote, the Negro, end quote, James Conley. This approach was well-suited to Ochs's Southern sensibilities, for, despite his new Northern address, he remained, in his heart, a true believer in white supremacy. In 1878, Ochs began his newspaper publishing career at the Chattanooga Times in his home state of Tennessee. When he took over America's, quote, paper of record, end quote, in 1896, he brought with him the racial culture and traditions of a Jim Crow city. Scholar Stephen Bloom wrote that Ochs, quote, possessed many Southern prejudices against the Negro, which were often evident in Times editorials, end quote. The position of the Times on racial issues, Bloom continued, quote, was either silent or hostile, end quote. Decades after the Emancipation Proclamation, Ochs offered his New York Times readership a black employment plan that included, quote, driving the men to work, end quote, in the fields, quote, with a few blows, end quote. After which, quote, the Negro goes resignedly and sadly, like a cow, while an occasional whack urges him on, end quote. Said the 1901 article, quote, Northerners cannot realize how low in intelligence, how irresponsible the pure Negro is. He is an animal, even worse than most animals. End quote. In the very same issue, the Times decried the attitude of blacks who did not appreciate the, quote, opportunities, end quote, to pick cotton. Quote, unfortunately, the Negro is degenerating. Were he differently constituted, he would be infinitely more dangerous than he now has the energy to be. End quote. Another article disparaged, quote, the college-bred Negro, end quote, scoffing at W.E.B. Du Bois's talented tenth theory and further reinforcing the idea that all blacks would be better off working with their hands and not their minds. The front page of that issue advocated so strongly for the removal of voting rights for the blacks of Alabama that the Ku Klux Klan could not have offered a more strident argument. The Times worried that the black voters were a, quote, menace to the well-being and prosperity of the state, end quote. In another article, the Times editors recommended immediate investment in, quote, old mammy training schools, end quote, which would, quote, transform any intelligent colored woman into an old mammy, end quote. The Ochses insisted that, quote, we love the Negroes. We must look after them, but keep them in their place. They are fine as long as they stay in the kitchen, end quote. The Times' printed racial wisdom was casually framed by prominent advertising by Jewish merchants and retailers with the names Simonson, Haas, Koch, Altman, Siegel, Arnheim, Stern, Fisher, Weber, Wisner, Seidenberg, Abraham, Strauss, Krauss, Milken, and Miller. It took the Times until 1930, 65 years after the end of slavery, to even capitalize the word Negro. The Grand Wizard and founder of the Ku Klux Klan, William J. Simmons, was capitalizing Negro in his published writings a full decade earlier. Racism was nuts and bolts standard practice for Adolf Ochs, and it would be on full display in the Times' coverage of the Leo Frank affair. Be with us again next time when we present the next chapter of The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews, Volume 3. The Leo Frank Case, The Lynching of a Guilty Man. Prepared by the Historical Research Department of the Nation of Islam, Chicago, Illinois. Copyright 2016 by Latimer Associates. All rights reserved. Published in audiobook form by the American Mercury with permission of the Historical Research Department of the Nation of Islam.